Welcome to this edition of What's Up Bainbridge, brought to you by BARN, Bainbridge Artisan Resource Network. I'm your host, Barb Trafton, Executive Director of the Bainbridge Island Parks Foundation, and I'm here today to talk with several very knowledgeable folks about the Moratani Preserve, our community's newest park and valued public open space in Winslow, which you can find at the very west end of Winslow Way. This podcast invites you, the listener, to consider the Moratani Preserve as a forest being restored. I'd like to begin by acknowledging that we gather today on the ancestral homelands of the Coast Salish peoples, who have lived in the Salish Sea Basin throughout the Salish Sea Islands and the North Cascades watershed from time immemorial. Please join me in expressing our deepest respect and gratitude for our Indigenous neighbors, the Suquamish Nation and the Port Gamble Tsklallam Tribe, for their enduring care and protection of our shared land and waterways. This podcast is part of the community conversation organized through the Association of Bainbridge Communities Environmental Conference Series about the future of our island forests in the face of climate change. Welcome to the conversation. So, as ED of the Parks Foundation, I wanted to express that the Parks Foundation is deeply interested in this topic because we want to help care for our public parks. And as a proud owner of public lands, you may know that our park district manages more forest acreage on Bainbridge than any other entity. Trees and connected forests, large and small, extend through all residential and business areas of Bainbridge Island. And from 3,000 feet, we look like a forest. Tree canopies cover approximately 70% of our island. If we take a closer look, what do we know about island forests? What does forest health mean? And what threats do climate change present our forests? Moratani Preserve is a good example of a pocket forest, which is essentially an urban reforestation approach, connecting smaller parcels. We want to reproduce the natural dynamics of a forest by reintroducing native biodiversity. So on our panel today, I am very pleased to welcome Marianne Kirkby, the chair of Friends of Moratani Preserve and a longtime island landscape designer. Mallory Weinheimer, CEO of Chickadee Forestry, contractor for Jefferson County, and author of the Moratani Preserve Sustainable Forest Plan. And Jay Kinney, elected commissioner for the Bainbridge Island Metropolitan Park and Recreation District. Jay has served our community for 10 years, and along with his colleagues, he provides management oversight to over 1,500 acres of parkland. So, Mallory, Marianne, and Jay, thank you for being here to discuss the Forest of Moratani Preserve.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Marianne, let's start with you. Before we talk about the pocket forest at Moratani Preserve, will you tell us a bit about the history of this land and your relationship to it and how it became a park?
Sure. The Moratani Forest Preserve is 8.5 acres of rolling topography that encompasses a perimeter forest, open fields, trails, and some mowed lawn gathering spaces. It's really a gem in our urban environment. We're very, very lucky to have had it preserved. It's an open space that the community has long been interested in preserving. And thanks to the Fletcher Bay Foundation, they privately purchased it and got it cleaned up, which was a very major effort, and then donated it to the park district. So it forever will be an open space in downtown Winslow.
We are so lucky, you are right. And Jay, you were on the park board when the Fletcher Bay Foundation made the gift of Moratani Preserve to the district. Why is this preserve so valuable to our community?
Well, you know, open spaces are unfortunately are just disappearing at a very alarming rate. So anything that's, you know, bigger than a small building lot that we can get is just a real gem. The big pieces in particular are going fast, and this was a great example of a lovely you know, park. It wasn't a park when they got it. They had to do a lot of work to get it, you know, in a situation where, you know, people could enjoy it. But there's not a lot of them left. There's very few of them left. And this is a really sizable open area for the public in a densely populated part of the island. So it's really, when you lose it, it's irreplaceable.
Yeah, right. It's a great example of public-private partnership too. It's what a gain for the community.
Yeah, if I can add something to that, Barb.
Please.
Because a few gentlemen came to the park district a few years before the Fletcher Bay was able to get it and asked if we, you know, if we could, we had the funding for it, and we just didn't. And it was heartbreaking to see that opportunity there and think that we were going to lose it, that it was going to get developed. And then, you know, the next thing I knew, you know, a private entity had come in and taken care of it and not just bought it and turned it over, but bought it and really cleaned it up. There was all sorts of old, you know, ferry equipment and things on the property from, you know, when it had been in use before. So, yeah.
Yeah, I know. That's so true. I think everyone was, there was a lot of panic when it first sold. Nobody knew what was going to happen. And the fear was major development. So what a miracle. Marianne, you helped design the Moritani Preserve as we know it now, pathways, meadows, and other amenities. What were the goals for the preserve and the hopes for its future?
I think one of the obviously biggest goals was to have it be a gift to the public and to the community. I think that the Fletcher Bay Foundation set very high standards in terms of developing it to a point where it could be immediately used and enjoyed by the public, which was a really great gift. It needed a lot of cleanup. There were even a lot of creosote logs on the site that had to be pulled out and recycled. A lot of outbuildings. There, of course, was an old historic farmhouse, and that really was not in good enough shape to preserve. So that came down. They did preserve the entry steps going into it. So there are some bits of history and historical markers there. Some of the old farm equipment was saved and is still on site. I think it's such an interesting place because it does hold these bits of history. Even the way the Doug firs in the forest are planted in rows, very reminiscent of the old strawberry fields that were there. Of course, at this point, we don't really want to see those straight rows of Doug firs, but it is very telling of some of the history of the site. So I worked with the Fletcher Bay Foundation to lay out trails and really try to analyze what this 8.5 acres all offered. There was an old garden site, there are open fields, and we created, the old farmhouse was sitting on a knoll of land, and that has become probably the heart of the preserve. We placed some very large pieces of granite on that knoll, and it's now, I have to say, a real gathering point in the preserve. And it's wonderful to see children playing up there, rolling down the hill, running, laughing, and it's just a special place that is serving a lot of needs now. The Fletcher Bay Foundation wanted to establish a management plan before it was turned over. And I think this also was a really good move on their part to set some guidelines for the future of the preserve. So I worked with Applied Ecology to write that management plan, and we broke down the site into a number of forest zones and open space zones so that it could more easily be managed. And goals were established for each of those zones. And that's what the advisory committee has continued to work with.
And the advisory committee of the Friends of Moritani Preserve has worked with the Park District, and work is funded through the Parks Foundation. Tell us, how did you find and approach Mallory as a sort of outreach of the management plan to look at a forest management plan?
The management plan addressed certain goals, and we knew that we needed to take further steps to implement those goals. So finding a forester was one of those action steps that the committee needed to take. And we gathered a few forestry company names, and Mallory came and interviewed, and she just seemed like a really good fit for what the Moritani Preserve needed. And she was very open about working with our advisory committee, which became a lovely educational partnership for all of us. And we have continued to follow her advice, and we have that plan now as an adjunct to the management plan. And hopefully that will carry us into the next 10 years, 15, 20 years of working with the forest to diversify it.
Well, it's great to think back 10 years and see where this property has where it's come from and where it is now, and then to think ahead. Mallory, as the author of the Forest Stewardship Plan for Moritani Preserve, describe for us what we see. If somebody is walking in from Winslow Way, what are they going to see in terms of the forest? What will the visitors recognize, and what more should they know about the forest as it is now, its makeup and its health?
So when you're walking in from that southwest corner, or southeast corner.
Southeast.
You walk into what I would say is the healthiest and most mature stand on the property. And those trees are around 40 to 50 years old. And they're bigger in diameter. They're nice, big, straight trees. There's a little bit more diversity. There's there's grand firs. I have to double check myself here. But there's where the other stands on the property are, it's pretty much only Douglas fir in there. And this one had some different planted trees, which was exciting to see. There's also, because these trees have matured, because they're overstocked, there's the crowns are smaller than they should be. The trees are all in competition across all of the property for sunlight and resources. So the understory is pretty bare in a lot of areas. So the forest is fairly dark, a lot of bare ground, a lot of places where you can just see through, and there's no saplings, there's not much of an understory shrub layer. And as Marianne pointed out, in some of those stands, there you can see straight lines in the trees. So it is very reminiscent of a home site, but it's also something that, it's a project I really love. I was just listening to Braiding Sweetgrass today while I was out in the field appropriately. And it's a book about blending indigenous knowledge about the land and ecological science. And this section was specifically about restoration. And I try and keep myself thinking about these things all the time. And there's a great concept in the UK going around right now, and I really wish that we could adopt this term in the US more, and I'm going to push for it, called rewilding. And it's happening a lot in land management. So helping to transition these properties that was a home site back into something that can sustain more natural ecosystems. So it is this blend of a home site and planted forest, and I think it will always have those elements, but we're hoping to reintroduce the parks folks are going to reintroduce more natural elements to blend that forest and these different goals.
Which that's great. And I wanted to just say, I love Braiding Sweetgrass too. What a fabulous book. And just for those of you who are listening, the author is Robin Wall Kimmerer. And I can't remember what tribal association she has, but it is a fabulous book. It really is deep and inspiring and great book to think about along with forest health. And what would optimal forest health look like here? Like if you were to walk in and imagine yourself 50 years down the road coming in and you know, what would you see? What would Murutani look like, that same stretch?
Yeah, I think it's important to know that it's not ever going to be, you know, what forest was pre-colonization and all of that. So it's going to be hopefully this beautiful blend of different goals. It's a pocket forest in an urban area where people can come and get a glimpse of like what a more natural environment is, still with only a few minute walk outside their door. So in terms of structurally what the forest is going to look like is we're hoping that the forest, first of all, Murutani went through, they had a small thinning and we went through with the parks board, gosh, 2020 flew by. I don't even remember when we went through and we did a demonstration to go and mark trees and do this randomized pattern of how to design a thinning, which was lovely to just do with a group of people, because often I'm working with a logger or something to design those, but actually to have people go out and mark trees that they thought that were the least healthy to go and mark those for removal, it really created this more randomized pattern. It was natural. And so I think that kind of work is going to keep continuing to build. I think there will be more planting parties and hopefully where those forests are pretty dark and bare and sparse on the understory, hopefully, you know, 10 years down the road, 15 years down the road, you'll be seeing new trees in the understory. You'll be seeing more understory native plants and vegetation that would have naturally been occurring in those soils and in that ecosystem, and more wildlife, and hopefully plants that can self-propagate and are starting to spread and adapt, and that the forest is responding to restoration. And so it's kind of a joint partnership of people and the landscape restoring itself.
Yeah, that's great. So really the thinning was the first step.
Yes.
For the Friends of Murutani Preserve and for the Park District. And I know the Park District have some terrific staff and did a good job, enjoyed following your plans to make that happen. You can see some of the logs, some of the trees down now under the in the understory, and that will just help the diversity there.
Right.
Yeah. So Jay, this makes me think about the fact that the plan will help bring about vibrancy and biodiversity. And it makes me wonder, does the Park District have forest management plans for other parks?
Well, the answer to that is no, but we're working on them. So the Murutani Preserve plan is really a template that we love having that. And we're going to the extent we can apply it to other forests, we will. But the other forests are different. I mean, parts of the, you know, Grand Forest and Gasm, some of the trees are much bigger. Rockaway Bluff, which is a new park, or not a park yet, but it's a will come into ownership at some point. That forest seems much different than, you know, Gasm or Grand Forest. So the things about the planet are so good. They, you know, identifying, you know, taking care of the invasives and getting rid of them, having a different vertical tree structure. To, instead of everything just of the same height, you know, 50-year-old trees are all the same height and, you know, blocking out all the sun, you get some vertical difference there. We are very worried about wildfire issues, given what's going on in California. So recently we established a forest management committee. Ken DeWitt and I are on that. And already, you know, we're just, I won't say flooded, but there's an awful lot of literature out there from forest managers about, you know, particularly how to deal with fires. And we want not just to have a fire plan, but we want a forest health plan. And I think the key is to think long-term. It's going to take a lot of money. It's about $5,000 per acre to go in and thin and get rid of invasives and replant, which is an awful lot of money. We've gotten, over the years, we've gotten pretty far with the Student Conservation Corps, for instance, and another organization that brings in goats. They're kind of the first wave of getting rid of some of the thick invasive vegetation that's on the ground. So we're working on it. So when I say we don't have a plan, doesn't mean we don't do anything. And we take care of diseased trees, we take care of root rot, and invasive plants and things like that. But we don't have an enormous budget and a settled plan that we with markers that we can go forward on. So we're very early in this process.
But isn't it great that you've started it? And isn't it nice to have the model of this one? I think that it seems as though in the last 20 years, acquisition has been the goal, increasing the acreage, and you've increased the total holdings of the park district by so much with work from all sorts of organizations helping, from the land trust, grants from the Recreation and Conservation Office. But it's great that you guys are thinking and planning forward like this. I know I'm grateful.
And it's been great how much land, how much forest land has been preserved on the island, because we could look like Bellevue if it weren't for the commitment of the people here to preserve, forests and open space. So we're very lucky.
Yeah. And now a good time to start thinking even more. And that's what this whole environmental conference is about, is starting the conversation. It is such a new science, it seems like, in some ways, as we think about my next question here, which is, this one's for you, Mallory. As I imagine 20 years from now, beautiful natural pocket forest, maybe it's still in restoration, but it's more diverse than it is now, and it is beautiful. But let's talk about climate change. What threats are presented or can we anticipate due to the climate crisis that we're facing?
Gosh, it's a big question. And it's a mix of things. And really the approach that I take is preventative approach, because I was just listening to a forest health data presentation from Department of Natural Resources for Washington State for the last 10 years of their findings. And there's just such a mix of issues going on. A colleague of mine is an ecologist for Olympic, Rainier, and North Cascades National Parks. And so I was asking her about the issues that she's seeing. And I'm always trying to figure out, like, what are the trends that we're seeing? And there's odd things, like, I know over the past few years, we've seen more cedar die-offs, hemlocks are dying off. I don't know if you guys know about this or have seen this much in Bainbridge, but there's massive like patches of sword ferns dying off in the forest too. I know that's happening in Seattle, and we have it here on the east side of the peninsula, and Salal patterns are changing. I think the pine beetle's coming. I mean, I don't need to go through the laundry list of things, but basically our forests are threatened and they're under stress, and I think the stresses are only going to increase with climate change. And so I think our management goal is not necessarily to identify the laundry list of risks that are coming, but how do we improve forest health? How do we improve the overall immune system of the forest and give it the best edge? And so that diversifying, that restoring of the native species and mix of native species, mix of ages, giving them space to grow. That's really, that's where I put my faith and my energy in helping landowners.
Yeah, sounds great. So really it's biodiversity is going to help create resiliency.
What I'm hoping.
We're hoping. Yeah. I'm wondering, Marianne, do you have any other thoughts about that, as with your background in landscape design as well?
No, I'm just really curious if I could ask Mallory a question. When we talk about diversity, we usually think of diversity within our existing native plant palette here in the Northwest. But I'm wondering how she is thinking or feeling about expanding that species list beyond what we are used to as native plants here.
Totally. And that is a great question. Something that I have been getting more and more, especially in the past year. And I've read a lot about climate assisted migration. I think that's what it's called, basically, and looking at what species are coming and how those patterns change. And I think really, from what I have read and understood, that change is going to be slow enough that, you know, I've heard some people say that like Douglas fir is not going to last. Like, this is the last population of Douglas fir that's going to grow in the Northwest. And I just don't believe that. I could be wrong. But there's, I think that things are going to change, but it's going to be gradual. And we're, I mean, not gradual comparatively, but it's going to be slow enough that we can keep responding. I think if we're planting other things, we're helping with climate migration of species. I would go personally towards South Puget Sound and Willamette Valley. I wouldn't go beyond that. I have some folks that have come to me that are really striving to plant redwoods and sequoias, like completely. And I just don't, while that's fine, I don't want to give up on our native species that are still doing okay here. I want to give them a chance. So I don't really think that sequoias and redwoods are going to be coming up to the Olympic Peninsula and Bainbridge Island in the next 50 years. But
so we know that the forests will be more resilient to the threats of climate change if we can make them more biodiverse. But what are the steps that we can take to do that, Mallory, other than thinning?
Yeah, I think thinning is generally with all the clients that I work with, thinning is often the first prescription, just because most of us have inherited Douglas fir uniformly planted forests to some degree. So the goal is to make them more biodiverse and more structurally diverse and ages of trees. So thinning is a first step, remove some of that biomass and then start planting. You know, the proverb, best time to plant a tree was 20 years ago. Second best is today. That holds. There are great places to get trees. A couple of my favorites are Sound Native Plants, Woodbrook Native Plant Nursery down in Gig Harbor, and your conservation district has an annual plant sale that is really the cheapest source. So planting trees, planting understory plants, figuring out what was naturally occurring there. And you can get help with that from contacting your conservation district, contacting a forester, looking at your soil type. So NRCS has that information. Just looking at what was there historically and trying to help rebuild that ecosystem and those different tree species, ages, and understory, and see how it adapts and how it adjusts, what works and what doesn't over time.
Sounds like a project that we're going to get going and hand on to our grandchildren and their grandchildren.
Exactly.
So, Jay, Moritani Preserve, as you said, is a small forest in the park district. There are many different forested parcels with different structures and trees and age and everything. But are there lessons here that you can apply to other forested parkland?
Are there lessons to apply? Well, every time we have a good, you know, private-public partnership, like this one, we learn things from it, and it's been great, you know, working on the Moritani Preserve. The financial assets that were brought in help us tremendously. As you know, we're, you know, a park district, so we're responsible for, you know, recreational programs and sports fields and the pool, so we literally don't have any extra money. So, you know, one thing we learned about from Moritani is it's possible to do something this size, and we can probably scale it up. And we're looking forward to that.
Yeah, good question. Good comments. And yeah, again, it's just the beginning, it seems. But there are people who live near all our forests, and I think a lot of people who care. And in fact, I think now I have a question for all three of you, which is, well, I think I can safely say that many Islanders feel like I do, We love our beautiful forested parks and want to understand what each of us can do to help support them and make them climate resilient forests. So how can people be a force for nature? And what actions can we take today that'll make a difference tomorrow? And I'd love a few points from each of you, or one big point, whatever comes top of mind.
Well, I can start just to get involved. I mean, come to a park district meeting. We have a trails committee. It's a great way to get involved with, you know, to get out into the forest and work, you know, work on it. We love to have the public participate, and then it becomes a way to volunteer. You know, we have the Student Conservation Corps and, you know, other volunteer groups. And as we go get into the forest management, we'll probably are going to have, you know, times when we send people in to thin and pull out invasives and things like that. And it's we get a long way with volunteers on this island.
That we do. Mary Ann, how about you? Speaking of a volunteer for Moritani Preserve.
Yes. The advisory committee has worked hard to set up a lot of work parties, and the park district staff has been phenomenal in working with the advisory committee to help advertise and recruit. And I know the Parks Foundation has a somewhat new program about working with nonprofits to get work parties, volunteer work parties out there. So all of those efforts translate to getting work done on the ground. And I think that is, you know, offering up physical help and offering up time is certainly one of the best ways. The other way is really just to support Moritani Preserve through donations. And those donations can be made through the Parks Foundation, and that goes directly into the budget that helps achieve the management guidelines for Moritani. And there's some exciting things coming up. One of the things we're looking at doing is a pollinator garden out there, and that's just another, that's going to mostly be wildflowers. And just another way to encourage beneficial insects and butterflies, and another way to diversify. So any of those things that can be done by the community really, really help support the work.
Fabulous. Yeah, and those gifts can help buy those, the financial gifts can help purchase plants too, right, for the understory.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mallory, how about you? What more can we do as citizens?
Yeah, I will chime in with Jay and Mary Ann and say volunteering. I've sat on my own county parks board for 4 years now and volunteer. And I think learning to take care of the land is one of the most important things we can do as citizens. I think another thing that isn't always on the front of our minds, and I don't think it's talked about enough, is in forest, at least for forests, we talk all the time about buying local food and supporting local farmers and organic farming. And we all use wood and paper products, but thinking about where you're getting those from and trying to support sustainable forest practices, trying to buy wood from local sources as much as you can is really important if we're ever going to change this dynamic of how we manage forests. Globally. And one of the big things you can do is get FSC, Forest Stewardship Council certified products. You can get that in wood in like Lowe's or that sort of thing, or buy it from someone you know. I just had wood milled at our own property, and it was cedar. We did a small harvest and we milled cedar, and it was a sustainable harvest, and it was a lot cheaper even after the cost of the harvest and the milling than what you would buy at Home Depot. So Working with friends, neighbors, that sort of thing, trying to create local sustainable wood economies and revalue forest for forest, but also for forest products is really important.
Yeah, that's a good point. And we won't be doing a lot of harvesting on our parklands, but who knows, maybe if there's some thinning, some of that can go into local resources. Good points. Well, I want to thank all three of you for helping us see Mauritania Preserve and all of our Bainbridge forests with deeper understanding. And I thank our listeners. I encourage you to download this podcast and take a walk at Mauritania Preserve. If you want to know more, please explore the ABC Virtual Environmental Conference events. You'll find info and helpful links on the Bainbridge Island Parks Foundation website and other nonprofit websites, such as Islandwood, Sustainable Bainbridge, and the Land Trust. I wish all listeners a thought-provoking walk through the preserve as you contemplate the words of our guests and the opportunities and challenges for the pocket forest at Mauritania Preserve. Thanks to our audience for listening to this episode of What's Up Bainbridge, which is a community service brought to you by BARN, Bainbridge Artisan Resource Network.